Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Matthew LeClaire. This is Equal Time for Free Thought, the show that brings rationality, critical thinking, and scientific naturalism to the people in the hopes of fostering positive social change. My guest today is Dr. Michael Shermer, the founding publisher of Skeptic Magazine, the founder of the Skeptic Society, and author of books including Why Darwin Matters, The Believing Brain, The Moral Arc, and the subject of today's show, Skeptic, Viewing the World with a Rational Eye, which was released last week and published by Henry Holt. Dr. Shermer's work as a professor, public speaker, writer, and historian has led him to the point in his career where he can release a book which contains a collection of his writings, so we know he definitely has a good deal to say and contribute to this show as a guest, so we'll just jump right into it. Welcome to the show, Dr. Shermer.
Oh, thanks for having me. I appreciate that, and thanks for the nice comment.
Absolutely, and we're definitely going to talk mostly about your most recent book today, but before we get there, I want to start off by talking just a little bit about your history. And as I understand it, you were once a fundamentalist Christian, and now I think it's safe to say you're not. So what what brought you into fundamentalist Christianity to begin with? What led you to leave it behind, and what was the journey like?
Oh, well, I wasn't raised religious. I was influenced by my peer groups, which is often the case. After parental influence is peer group influence. And when I was in high school, a bunch of my friends became evangelical, born-again Christians. And I just thought it would be, you know, an interesting thing to try and do and to see what it was all about. And so I did. And I remember one of my religious friends, Frank, was disappointed in me because it turns out he was a Jehovah's Witness, and I picked the wrong one. I went to the Protestant church for my born-again experience, and he goes, oh, no, that's the wrong one. I thought, the wrong one? What?
Oh, no.
My first introduction to the nature of religion.
Huh.
But I got into it, you know, mostly, I'd say, Protestant evangelical bent of the whole thing. And then I went to Pepperdine University in Malibu, which is a Church of Christ school out of Texas. The Church of Christ church is out of there. And it's a pretty conservative Christian campus. And, you know, when you're in that bubble, you're pretty much surrounded by fellow believers and everything is reinforced. And it feels really good. And it's internally consistent and coherent. And it makes sense as long as you're surrounded in that bubble. But when I went to graduate school, which was a secular institution, Cal State Fullerton, for a master's degree in experimental psychology, I was no longer in the bubble, and it's not like it was a big atheist thing. You know, this was late 70s, and the whole atheist, theist, science, and religion debate that we have today was a non-starter. That no one cared about it, no one was talking about it, it didn't matter. But no one was religious either, so, or maybe they were, but they were quiet about it. And so it just never came up, and except for after-class discussions, like at the 301 Club, which was this bar in Fullerton after the evolution class that I was taking from 7 to 10 p.m. on Tuesday nights, then the whole whoever wanted to go along with the professor would go to this bar and we'd sit around till closing time just talking about, you know, all the cool stuff that college students like to talk about, you know, science and religion and God and free will and, you know, the nature of the universe and the meaning of purpose and all that. So that was pretty fun. And then after that, the whole religion thing just was sort of dormant, except I got interested in the creationist movement in the 80s, because that's when there was the big court case with the Louisiana creationism case that went all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court, and I followed that pretty closely. And so that kind of got me back into the science and religion area, and it kind of rejuvenated my atheism, as it were. I didn't really call myself anything because, again, nobody cared and no one asked. You know, today everyone asks, are you an atheist? Are you a theist? You know, and before that wasn't really a thing that people asked.
Do you think that that's a college specific thing that nobody asked? Or do you think that that was more just a general public stay away from this subject issue?
I think there just wasn't that much interest in it. I think what we're seeing now began in the 90s, after the moral majority in the 80s became pretty politically powerful, and, you know, the election of George W. Bush then in 2000 and then 9/11, you know, I think all that kind of pushed the dangerous nature of religion to the forefront, whereas before people just sort of thought of it as a quaint, nice thing that people have on their in their life on the side, you know, on Sundays or whatever. But it wasn't a big thing, and now it is, and for obvious reasons. You know, you can just see it in the daily news that, you know, people act on their beliefs, and if their beliefs are of a certain kind of religion that encourages violence, then yeah, then it's a problem.
Right. And I guess that's kind of why maybe I was a little bit surprised to hear you just say that in a way, you were a fundamentalist Christian for a period of time, but at the same time, you seem to be saying that it sort of wasn't all that big of a deal. And so for me, that almost sounds it's completely counterintuitive, because I envision any fundamentalist Christian to be as adamant and as driven as the craziest people that I know.
Oh, they are, and I was at the time, you know, when I was into it, that is, being an evangelical, by definition, you're supposed to evangelize. That's what the name means, which right. means you're supposed to tell people about it. And, you know, if you really believe that accepting Jesus is the way to eternal life, then you kind of have a moral obligation to tell people about it and save their souls. And so I first drove my family crazy by constantly bringing it up at family dinners. and my friends, you know, my friends that were religious, they understood, but the ones that weren't, you know, I was like, oh, this again.
You know, this seems so backwards, actually, because, you know, most of the stories that I hear about people who grew up, or at least when they were younger, they were brought into the fundamentalist Christian fold, it was usually because of the parents and not the other way around. So to me, this is an extra interesting story.
Yeah, mine's slightly unusual, although not everybody who's religious was raised that way, but that is pretty common. I mean, the number one predictor of anybody's religiosity is that of their parents. It's right. not that it's 100%. You know, you'll always find people who go, well, you know, I was raised Jewish, but now I'm whatever. That yeah. does happen, but much more common is you know, that you follow your parents, that are your family or your immediate culture and or subculture and group that you hang out with. You know, we're very social, and so a big predictor of lots of things, you know, like whether you smoke or not, how obese you are or not, depends on the people you hang around with. Are they smokers? Do they eat a lot? You know, are they into sports or not, in terms of exercise and diet and health? And, you know, that very much has an influence on our lives. And certainly that's the case with religion.
And do you think that there was something about your personality that led you to become at one point a fundamentalist Christian and then later on a serious bike rider? And then later on with the Skeptic magazine, with the Skeptic Society, all the work that you've done, it seems like there is something about that feeling of being so driven that can allow someone to become so dedicated to one thing or another. So do you think that it's something about you in particular, or is this something that happens to pretty much anyone?
Oh, it's definitely a part of my temperament and personality to do things professionally and seriously if I'm going to do them. You know, so if I'm going to take up Christianity, well, then I really should read the Bible, and I should read books about the Bible, and I should take courses in the Bible, and which I did at Pepperdine. I had a course on the New Testament, the Old Testament, the life of Jesus, the writings of C.S. Lewis. You know, we were required to take religion courses, but to be honest, I kind of liked it. Well, the Old Testament course was pretty boring. It's mostly just memorizing lists of kings and rules and you know, so forth. But the New Testament was more interesting, and then the writings of C.S. Lewis and all that. Like, I have a book called The Parallel Gospels that I still have from my course on Jesus the Christ, in which they actually, you know, have them parallel. It's right there, you know, the differences between the Gospels. And, you know, there's much hand-wringing within the bubble of, you know, how do we square that circle when this one says this and this one says that. You know, but again, it's not presented in the context of maybe we shouldn't believe. It's just an interesting theological problem or historical problem that we can work on. You know, of course, now I use it in a different way.
Of course. And that's something that I've been wondering, too, just in looking at some of your previous writings and generally your career as a whole. When did you begin to start the process of turning this critical thinking and skepticism into a career, into writing about it? When did that begin?
Well, it probably began, I guess, with the I did an article for a scholarly journal, the Social Studies of Science, on the Louisiana creationism case that unfolded in 87. The Supreme Court voted in early 88, and I published my paper in 89 and started Skeptic Magazine in 92. So that in that time is when I started thinking, sort of writing seriously, scholarly, professionally about that, those kinds of topics. And when we started the Skeptic Magazine in 1992, we also started the lecture series at Caltech, science lecture series, and of course there was already a skeptical movement underway. You know, the Skeptical Inquirer magazine, PsyCop, the Committee for the Scientific Investigation of Claims of the Paranormal, Paul Kurtz, James Randi, Ray Hyman, and so forth. You know, there was already something of a movement afoot, and I just kind of glommed onto that and pushed it forward even further myself and got onto that. And now it's quite a big thing. I mean, there's lots and lots of magazines all over the world, several called Skeptic, actually. There's a Skeptic in England, a Skeptic in Australia, and then, of course, our Skeptic. And then a Skeptical Inquirer, and you know, there's other magazines as well. And so what that tells us is that there's a market for it, that is, people really want to know. You know, like the masked magician on Fox, you know, he's going to expose the secrets. Oh, no, no one wants to know. Yeah, they do. They really do want to know. We want to know, damn it.
Yeah, well, that, you know, that's funny because I feel like there are so many people that do actually want to know and do want to be skeptical about pretty much everything, anything that we're told, anything that we read, anything that we learn. But it seems that even the term skeptic by itself, for many people, comes along with negative connotations, to say the least. Why do you think that's the case?
Oh, well, first of all, people seem to confuse it, strangely, with cynic, skeptic and cynic. Even though they have nothing to do with each other. And I guess historically, though, skeptics are sort of associated with curmudgeonly denial type people. And even now, you know, people say, oh, I'm a climate skeptic. And then, you know, then skeptics like me say, no, you're not. You're a climate denier. Or Holocaust deniers, they call themselves skeptics. Creationists claim they're skeptical of evolution and they're the real skeptics and we're the fake skeptics. And okay, so what does it mean? Well, it's just really a scientific way of looking at the world. Scientists are skeptics. We begin with the null hypothesis, which is that your hypothesis is not true until you prove otherwise. So the burden of proof is not on me to disprove your hypothesis. You have to run the experiments and present the data and have it peer-reviewed or evaluated by the FDA or whatever. You can't just say you have a cure for AIDS. You actually have to present to the FDA your evidence to, you know, before they'll approve your drug or whatever. So that's all it means. And so, you know, and somebody says, are you a climate skeptic or are you skeptical of the climate skeptics? Well, I'm skeptical of the global warming skeptics, which I guess makes me a believer. But even that's a little bit problematic on the language because believe in global warming. It just is. You know, it is. The evidence is there. It's actually happening. So period. End of story. It's not a belief like I believe in civil liberties or, you know, I believe in a progressive tax system or whatever. Those are different than, you know, data driven. I believe in, you know, the global warming, or I believe that evolution is true, or I believe the Big Bang happened. Those are different uses of the word belief.
And I know that you have an interesting history on climate change. And I guess since you mentioned it now, we should talk about it a little bit. There was actually a show that we did here on this program on the Merchants of Doubt film, and you appeared in that documentary. And the documentary, for those of you who don't know, it's basically about how large corporate interests have in the past manipulated the public's views on issues ranging from the dangers of cigarettes to the reality of anthropogenic climate change. And in that film, you talk a bit about your conversion, I guess I'll call it, on the issue of climate change. So can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yes, my conversion. it's like a religion, which some people kind of think of it as that. But no, this film, Robbie Kenner's film, based on Naomi Oreskes' wonderful book, The Merchants of Doubt, really does track the connection between the tobacco industry and their Doubt is Our Product famous memo, in which their goal was to, you know, hire these scientists that were just front men for these really political groups that were like lobby groups that protect an industry to then not debunk the claim that tobacco causes cancer, but just plant a seed of doubt. They couldn't debunk it because the evidence was pretty strong. Even in the 60s, by the 60s and 70s, it was overwhelmingly strong. So their goal was, let's just say the, you know, the evidence is not all in, or let's hear both sides, or, you know, any kind. So doubt is our product was the phrase. And so what Robbie Kenner and, you know, in his film version of Naomi's book showed was, it wasn't just the same strategies that the climate deniers have used, but in often cases, the same people, the same scientists that were hired by the tobacco industry are now hired by these, you know, like oil companies. And it's just revealing as all get out that, wow, you know, because I found when I wrote about the Holocaust deniers, I found very strong similarities and strategies to that of the creationists. But it wasn't the same people. It's completely different people. Here, it's the same people. Yeah. Anyway. So back to my evolution on that subject. When I was in college, I took a course in ecology in the early 70s, 1972. And so the field was brand new. There was no science of ecology. And Paul Ehrlich's book was a big hit, The Population Bomb. And there were all these predictions, you know, limits on growth, the Club of Rome, all these predictions of doomsday. And then by the 80s, the rainforest will be gone, we'll be out of oil, and precious minerals will be, you know, skyrocketing in price, and on and on and on, and none of this happened, not even remotely close did it happen. And so by the late 80s, early 90s, I thought, yeah, it's a bunch of hooey, you know, exaggeration. And but I didn't pay much attention to it for about a decade until the early 2000s, when I started reading I met Al Gore at TED and saw his talk. He gave his famous PowerPoint talk that was the basis of that film, the Inconvenient Truth. But before that, he gave that talk at TED, and I thought, wow, okay. I mean, I know he's a liberal and a politician and blah blah blah, but it was just him, the way he presented it, pointing to all the lines of evidence that I then went and read. So don't miss it, because people wrote me in my article in Scientific America about how can you listen to Al Gore? It's like, he's the messenger. Okay. I'd actually read the papers. I read the books, and, you know, I didn't just rely on Al Gore. Okay. But his lecture was so powerful because it put all the lines of evidence into one, you know, one package, and there it's pretty strong. Yeah. So, you know, I flipped on that, and as did most scientists who were on the fence. And so I think, you know, in combination was I wasn't paying attention to it, but also more importantly, a lot more evidence came in the late 90s and 2000s that we didn't have before that make it pretty clear what's going on.
Right. And I know that the reaction that you received, as that film showed at that libertarian conference you attended, was not exactly the most reasonable. There was that one guy that was standing up and just screaming at you, top of his lungs, and, you know, saying you lie and all that stuff, you know. So in situations like that, and looking at the history of climate change denial, why do you think it is that among, I don't want to say conservatives, because that's not quite the right term, but those who are at least less trusting of liberals as a whole, they took a longer time to come around to accept climate change as a reality, even though the science of climate change really didn't have anything to do with politics?
Yeah, it's definitely become politicized, as have a number of issues. Excuse me. Last night on Bill Maher, for example, he had on Al Gore. And Bill was pitching his theory that the reason conservative Christians don't accept climate change is because of their Christianity, and Gore was going, no, it's because of their conservatism, and I agree completely with Al Gore. Bill Maher's wrong about that. The reason that the people that deny climate do so, it has nothing to do with their religion. It's their almost faith-based commitment to free markets and capitalism, and the belief that without you know, that those kinds of markets, then you know, if there's control, too many government controls over the marketplace, which will go into place if climate change is real, you know, global warming is real and there's government restrictions put on it, then that's going to challenge our economic ideology. So it's not religious ideology, it's economic ideology in that case. But, you know, this cuts across various fields. I was in Berkeley this week promoting, doing a talk based on this book, Skeptic, and it was sponsored by KPFA, which is a very progressive, far left, liberal radio station here in California. Has a number of stations, and the one in Berkeley is uber liberal. I mean, Bernie Sanders would be a centrist for these guys. Okay, and standing there at the door were protesters protesting my appearance there, and they had pamphlets about 9/11. 9/11 is an inside job. Shermer's not a real skeptic. We're the real skeptics. You know, you have to face the fact. Huh. Building 7, thermite, blah blah blah, all that stuff that, you know, that's been so debunked thoroughly over the last 10 years by all the skeptics and scientists and so on, and they're hanging on to it. Why? Because it's really, they don't, in this case, you know, these are mostly pro big government people, but they don't trust the government in this particular case. And then vaccinations came up, and vaccinations are, you know, the anti-vaxxers. This cuts both left and right. People that don't like big corporations, liberals, they think it's, you know, it's big pharma that's running the whole show. And then, but conservatives, they think, well, it's the big government, you know, causing the problem. So the, you know, the vaccinations one is, you know, biased both politically, both left and right.
And I suppose that's kind of why it's hard to step into the world of trying to challenge assumptions, because in some respect, I think there are points that can be made for both sides of this, right? In other words, there's not, I guess what I'll call a monopoly on the truth by one political party or another. It's more just that you have to look at it with a, as you say, skeptical eye. And so in your process of writing what you wrote, such as these articles that are presented in your book, Skeptic, and taking on all kinds of claims, were there any that you were particularly driven to when you first started writing about pseudoscientific claims?
Well, again, I was, as I said, I was interested in the creationism field, and my doctorate is in the history of evolutionary thought. My doctorate's in history of science. My specialty is history of evolutionary thought, in particular Darwin and Wallace and how they developed their theories and the culture at the time and the response after. And so the creationism stuff comes in the skeptic connection to pseudoscience, science and pseudoscience, is that's an obvious linkage there. And then in terms of other topics that I cover, I mean, this book has 75 essays. I'm up to 180 now in Scientific American. 181 consecutive months I've written essays for Scientific American.
Wow.
And so bear in mind, I have to come up with something different every month. And, you know, I can't, you know, it's like, how many essays do you write? You know, astrology, is it real? You know, it's like, okay, we've done that one now.
Covered. Yeah.
You know, Bigfoot, is it real? No. Okay. So what next? So I'm interested in any topic that has some kind of scientific link to it, some connection. I mean, that would be my marching orders by my editors. In any case, this is Scientific American. What's the scientific connection? And also, what's the newsworthy linkage? I mean, why do we care about this particular thing right now? You know, like, for example, I wouldn't write about the Flat Earth Society because the only member died a few years ago. You know, so, you know, it's like, yeah, who cares? You know, but, you know, if it's something that there's some new study or discovery or a paper or a new book or somebody's new theory or, you know, something like that, you know, that would then draw interest to it. So, for example, my latest one I just submitted last week, I'm hoping they let me publish it because it's about bullshit. And it's a study on bullshit, on what do we mean by bullshit? What does that mean? You know, there's lots of, you know, different descriptors for that, you know, BS or baloney or bunkum or, you know, malarkey or whatever. What are we talking about? Well, and there's a paper on this, a scholarly paper done by three psychologists, and they did this study on 800 different subjects, giving them different, well, basically they used Deepak Chopra's Twitter feed, because it certainly sounds like bullshit.
Okay, wait, what is the title of it? Do you know the title? Because they must have come up with something creative, please.
Oh, no, they absolutely did, and here, I'll let me call up the title for you here on my laptop. It's very, well, my concern about Scientific American is they're very careful about language in the magazine, so
right,
I titled
right.
the column BS, but at some point you have to use the word because it's in the title of the paper.
Oh, yeah. Good.
Well, so they use there's also a web page dedicated to Deepak Chopra's Twitter feed, but it presents quotes that are either real Twitter feeds or just made up fake Twitter comments, and you have to guess if it's real or not, and you can't tell. Here's the article. It's called "On the Reception and Detection of Pseudo-Profound Bullshit." It's published in the journal Judgment and Decision Making this year. Oh, November, came out in November. Gordon Pennycook, James Allen Shane, Nathaniel Barr, Derek Kohler, and Jonathan Fuglesang. So Gordon Pennycook and James Allen Shane. James Allen Shane actually will be familiar to a lot of skeptics. He's published a number of articles on near-death experiences and sense presence and other sort of spooky psychological things people experience that they interpret as ghosts or aliens or demons or angels or God that are just in the brain. So he's really good at that kind of thing. And so what they're looking for here, like I'll give you some examples of bullshit. We are in the midst of a self-aware blossoming of being that will align us with the nexus itself. And another one is, today science tells us that the essence of nature is joy. So this is what they mean as pseudo-profound bullshit.
Wow.
Yeah, attention and inattention are the mechanics of manifestation. And this is an actual tweet composed by Deepak Chopra, and it's quoted in the paper as an example of pseudo-profound bullshit. And what they want to know is, are some people more likely to read that and go, wow, or what? And so the difference they found was that the more intelligent you are verbally, in particular verbal intelligence, and then the higher you score on these critical thinking tests, this cognitive reflection test it's called, then the less likely you are to be impressed by pseudo-profound bullshit. Now, it doesn't matter what it really means. It may mean something. You know, because you could read somebody an actual sentence from a quantum physics paper. You know, the writer meant it, and he knows what he meant. But you and I don't know it. It just sounds profound. What they're talking about is, it doesn't matter if it's real or not. Does it sound profound to you, or does it make you go, wait a minute? And that's what they're looking for. So I used in my column this example of this debate Deepak Chopra and I had at Caltech. Sam Harris and I debated him and Gene Houston. And in the Q&A, Leonard Mlodinow was there in the audience. He's a quantum physicist from Caltech. And Deepak Chopra was talking about consciousness, and he defined it as a superposition of possibilities. And Leonard Mlodinow replies to this in the Q&A, I know what each of those words means. I still don't know what you mean by consciousness. So pseudo-profound bullshit is just stringing together a series of words that in a sentence sound profound, but they don't actually mean anything, or maybe they do, who knows? So the problem is a lack of clear communication and clearly defining what terms mean, and that's the problem.
Well, we're getting a really good conversation going here so far, and for those of you just tuning in, I'm Matthew LeClaire, and you're listening to Equal Time for Free Thought on WBAI 99.5 FM, and I'm talking with Dr. Michael Shermer, and we're discussing his latest book, Skeptic. So we were just talking a little bit about words and and I think that's a great topic to stick with. And I have to say, one thing I really love about your book is that it brought some new words back into my vocabulary. For example, bunkum and balderdash, I have to say, I haven't heard or seen that for a while, and I appreciate your usage of it. But I, in terms of your writing, this is kind of a half-serious question here, but the serious part does remain. When were you first aware of how much you love alliteration?
Oh, I guess.
You know what I mean.
I know what you mean. I guess it must come from the influence of Stephen Jay Gould on my writings. You know, he was a very literary stylist in his essays, and I admired that, and I enjoyed reading it, much like I do Hitchens. Christopher Hitchens' writings are very, very elegant in that way, and so I strive for that. I'm not as good as Gould or Hitchens, but I strive for that. I enjoy the process, and good writing matters. I mean, there's a reason why, say, Sam Harris's books and Richard Dawkins' books do very well, because they're well written. And good writing still matters, and I like that. I'm pleased about that, because I think that, in the age of Twitter and Facebook and social media and short attention spans, it's nice to know that, long form essays, a nice 5,000 to 10,000 word essay or a 100,000 to 200,000 word book still matters. People still enjoy reading it. Steven Pinker's books are just magnificent treaties. They're just beautiful. They're huge. They're long. You got to sit down and spend hours, plowing through chapters. But
and I did.
good for you. Well, and it's nice to know that people still do that.
Yep. And for the listeners, I know I can say that you have done a good deal of alliteration, but I just have to give you some credit for things like Asimov's Axiom, Darwin's Dictum.
Oh, yes.
You have Shamans of Scientism, Mencken's Maxim, Quantum Quackery, Fox's Flapdoodle. I mean, these are beautiful, I have to say. Anyway, now that we've gotten that part out of the way, back to some more serious matters. The pseudoscientific claims that you talk about in this latest book, Skeptic, and obviously it's a collection of your previous writings, but it's a good collection because not only because of the writing, but because the collection covers probably more pseudoscientific bullshit than I think I would have been able to think about on my own. And in each case, you do your best to cover the points that they make about each specific issue and then explain why it doesn't make any sense, why the evidence doesn't point in that direction. Are there any specific pseudoscientific claims that you would determine to be the most unscientific? And are there any of those claims that you feel have caused more damage than others?
Well, I think in the realm of alternative medicine is where where the rubber really meets the road, because people act on their beliefs, and those actions can really make a difference either in their own individual lives or social or in society. So that vaccination issue is a classic one that we're experiencing right now, particularly in California here and in Oregon and Colorado and other areas where there's a lot of vaccination skepticism based on this bogus study, the Wakefield paper that was withdrawn and debunked, and he was determined to be fraudulent and had his medical license removed and the whole thing. And still people cite this paper and these, it's just based on anecdotal thinking. Parents get their children vaccinated and then, a handful of them every once in a while are diagnosed with autism, and they just immediately put the two together. A happens, then B happens. There must be a causal link. Not necessarily so, but nevertheless, the power of the anecdote is there. And that's different than, say, somebody reading their astrology column, which is mainly for entertainment purposes, and people don't act in dangerous ways based on what their astrology column says, but they do when it comes to these medical things. So those are the ones that I write about in the book and that we write about in Skeptic a lot. That's why we even have a regular column, Harriet Hall, the Skeptoc. Every issue she has something that and every one of them is important because people act on those. And, so there we have that collective, almost, commune problem of people that if enough people don't get vaccinated, you break the herd immunity. And then there's a risk of these communicable diseases spreading. And they are. This is the comeback of a few of these diseases in some of these communities, even here in L.A., and again, it's not that these are right-wing religious nuts. There's a lot of uber-liberal, atheist, secular, rich parents in Beverly Hills that are doing this, because they have a different kind of faith in sort of purity of food, purity of your body. Everything should be natural. They're anti-GMO, even though GMOs are great, and that sort of thing. So there's a whole other realm of skepticism there we need.
You probably just pissed off about half our audience, but that's okay.
Well,
but I mean that
again, what does the science say? GMOs. Even the uber liberal European Union are very cautious about these sorts of things. They've endorsed GMOs, and there's no evidence that GMOs have harm anybody. And they have the chance of really saving hundreds of millions of lives from starvation. It's almost a religious type mythology about natural. What's natural?
Right.
And if you walk into a Whole Foods, oh boy, half the products are marketed under this, it's organic, it's natural, and no GMOs, right. And, vegan, all the super uber vegan can't eat honey because it exploits the bees and all this stuff. you know, people take all that way beyond whatever the science says, because and there's actually studies on this that, you know, there's a reason religions have a lot of food regulations and taboos and things like that, because back in the day, you know, food was super, well, it's always important, but, you know, the food contamination and that sort of thing, and disease contagions and all that, were a serious threat. So that's why they have all those rules. Well, people still have those, even if they're not religious. They still have a lot of these sort of almost talismanic attitudes about food today.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think one of the hardest things in terms of discussing issues like this, particularly when it comes to something like food, is that I have an understanding for why it is that people would be distrustful, first of all, of anything that is new. I think that it's scary. We know that in the past that we've been told things that later on it turns out, oops, we were wrong. And, you know, I guess one of the biggest cases is probably something like the dangers of cigarettes, for example. But I just wonder, from your perspective in writing these articles, what do you suspect, or what do you strive towards in terms of your audience? Are you trying to write for the people who feel this way and trying to take them on and trying to get them to understand why it doesn't make any sense, or why the evidence suggests something other than what they believe? Or is this more just towards our own group?
A little bit of both. I mean, you never know who's reading Scientific American or Skeptic Magazine. They're on newsstands. You never know. Somebody just picks it up at a Barnes & Noble. You have no idea who they are. So you have to write it in a way that anybody could understand it. And I think that's quite doable without dumbing down, that crazy phrase, dumbing down. Just write clearly. That's all you need to do is write clearly. I mean, we're not doing quantum physics here, okay? So, you know, most of the social science stuff and medical stuff, you know, you can really write about pretty clearly without getting too jargon laden. And so I go for something that has a little bit of a hook or angle, or something that'll surprise, make people think, even if it's something you already believe. Like I wrote one a couple issues ago for Scientific American on climate. Okay, most readers of Scientific American and Skeptic accept the climate science. There's more skeptics than you would imagine, but still the vast majority accept it. Okay. So, my column then was about this study on thousands of papers that have been published in the field of climate science over the last 20 years, and a tally by these scientists that did this study, that 97% of the papers accept climate change is real and human caused. What about the 3%? You know, what if they're right? I mean, Galileo was right, you know, and so on. You know, maybe the minority is right. You know, a lot of times scientists are wrong about things. You know, they said the Earth was flat, you know, whatever. Okay, so how do we know that the 97% are right? Well, this study showed that in the 97%, they all kind of have the same lines of inquiry, lines of evidence that point to the same conclusion. You know, the tree ring data and the ice core data, and the rates of carbon dioxide increases, and ecological changes that are shifting, and you know, the Greenland ice cap, and so on and so on. But the 3%, there's no consistency in them. There's no constant pointing to what the real explanation is. That is, if you have an alternative theory to the mainstream theory, can it account for all the data that the mainstream theory can account for and the anomalies that the mainstream theory can't account for? On Michio Kaku's webpage, he has this little a button to click. Look, if you have an alternative theory of physics, click here. Okay. So, he gets these like I do, and lots of people get these that are public intellectuals. You know, I've been working on this theory. Newton was wrong, Einstein was wrong, Feynman and Hawking are wrong, and I worked it all out in my garage. Okay. Well, are you a physicist? No, I'm not a physicist. Have you asked a physicist? No, they won't accept it because it's too revolutionary, and, you know, scientists are too conservative, you know. Okay, so what Michio has is very clever. He's, you know, here are like the 37 different things that the standard model of physics can explain. your theory has to be able to explain all of those and something else that, you know, you're adding to it. And of course, you know, they never even get past that page because their theory can't, you know, explain anything. It's just, you know, some sort of esoteric way of using words. A lot of them will write me and go, you know, right. I don't really know the math, but if you'll help me with the math, I'll share the Nobel Prize with you. Yeah. First of all, I'm not your guy for the math. And second of all, like, you should walk down to the local high school physics teacher and just say, you know, in a humble way, like, I'm sure I'm wrong. Can you help me with this? Just show me where I'm wrong or why I'm wrong? Because, you know, those chances are pretty slim that I, average Joe, have, you know, figured out where Einstein went wrong.
Especially without doing the math.
Yes. You know, well, so they read the popular versions of these theories, which, you know, you and I read, but I don't understand the math. Now, I don't have faith in physics and physicists. I have confidence that that they have actually tested these theories themselves, and it's a competitive enterprise. And it's not like everybody wanted Einstein to be right. I mean, that, you know, people were trying to debunk him for, you know, for decades, and he still stands as, you know, one of the prominent great thinkers of all time for a reason. Not because his name was Einstein or everybody liked his theory. It was that he's right. And ultimately, that, you know, that's what it takes.
Since we're getting into the world of physics here, I'm reminded of an interview I conducted with Brian Greene a while back, and among other things, we talked about string theory. And there was no question in my mind then or now that string theory and other theoretical sciences are important, but the lack of string theory's ability to present the scientific community with any testable predictions makes it a challenge to even really classify as science. And he and I talked about this back and forth, but what do you think about it?
Well, I put that in the kind of borderlands of science, and or maybe somewhere between physics and metaphysics, or theoretical science that's not yet experimental science, or, you know, something like that. It's not pseudoscience for sure, but it's not, you know, rigid empirical science either. And so, and that's okay. You know, it's okay to have a spectrum. We'll call it the spectrum disorder, you know, where there's, you know, a different shades of probability of something being true based on, you know, good evidence, good arguments, good math, or whatever. And that's another example. Like, you know, I don't understand string theory, but, you know, I don't think that most physicists accept it just because they like Brian Greene or Michio Kaku or whoever. You know, they've looked at the math and gone, okay, well, you know, maybe it's this, maybe it's that, it has this probability of being true, who knows, we'll wait and see. You know, so there's the competitive nature of science leads me to be confident that when a consensus develops in a community that the theory is X, whatever that is, then I'm willing to go along with that until the community shifts, and then we can look at it again. It's like the climate consensus. What does that mean? It's to an outsider, it sounds like argument from authority or something like that. You know, you can't be skeptical because the consensus says it's real. Well, but that actually means something. It means that, you know, there's thousands of climate scientists that work in this field. They publish in the same journals. They go to the same conferences. They're very competitive. You know, a young scientist could really make a name for himself or herself by debunking the prominent theory or debunking some experiment or finding a flaw in experiment or whatever. You know, that's how you advance your career, is you do something new. And so the idea that science never changes, it's so conservative, it's dogmatic and closed-minded, is not true. It is conservative because most ideas that scientists present turn out to be wrong, but it's not completely closed off to change, or else we would never have all these new sciences that develop.
Why do you think so many people, I would say especially we can see this here in the United States, are, I don't want to use this word because I know it's not the right usage, but they're skeptical of science.
Yeah, it's an okay word. It's but what I think it has to do with is depends on the area. I mean, most people accept the science that goes into technologies like, you know, smartphones and GPS unit, you know, programs and 747 jets and, you know, it's like Dawkins' famous quote about, you know, you show me a, what was it? You show me a a postmodernist at 35,000 feet, and I'll show you a hypocrite. I don't trust science, you know, as he's typing away in his laptop, doing 35,000 feet, you know.
Yeah.
It has to do with certain areas that where science bumps into people's ideologies and beliefs. So climate change with economic ideologies, creationism with religious beliefs, you know, or certain, you know, social science theories, you know, that intelligence and, you know, racial differences in intelligence or gender differences in cognitive abilities, you know, any of these things that bumps up against a political or religious sensitive subject, then that's where people go, you know, I don't always trust the science. And, you know, really what it is, you know, you're making me nervous here. And so, you know, and admittedly, when science is bumping up against these really important issues, we do have an obligation to make sure we're right, that we're really clear about the evidence pointing to the support of this theory or that theory, like, say, something sensitive like gender or racial differences in something, anything. You better make sure you got the science right, because it can be slanted by your beliefs. And you really better triple check your data and have somebody that thinks differently from you politically make sure you're not getting it wrong, and for that very reason.
And I guess it does seem particularly important when people are talking about their experiences telling them something different from what the science is saying. And I think one of the articles that you wrote that points to that specifically is talking about UFOs, unidentified flying objects, which people then say are aliens. And in that process, you know, there are people who do have these experiences, and, you know, their reaction to somebody who says it's not real is to say, well, I experienced it. And so in challenging that and in talking about that, I wonder if there is some form of hope to be able to get through to people like that and get them to the point where they are able to at least understand that they can't always rely on even their own experiences, because the brain can do awfully strange things. But I'm not sure if I've seen anyone ever successfully get somebody to see that.
Yeah, it's hard. What I try to do is be sympathetic to the person and acknowledge that, yes, I understand your experience is powerful and meaningful to you, and I get it. I mean, if I have had something like that myself, I'll say, yeah, I was there with you, brother. I mean, I had experience like that. And I'll say, you know, I experienced being abducted by aliens, or I used to be a born again Christian, or I used to be a climate skeptic, or I used to be against gun control or whatever. If you can find some commonality with the person you're talking to, such that they feel like, this guy's not just trying to sell me a bill of goods. He's sympathetic to me. He used to think like I think. Okay, so why is he thinking differently now? Let me see if I can understand his position. And that kind of opens their mind a little bit to listening. You know, if you just say, look, you're wrong, and everything you believe is a bunch of bullshit, well, the wall's going up. You know, they're just going to be defensive. Of course, naturally, that's called cognitive dissonance. You know, Carol Tavris has a wonderful book about this called Mistakes Were Made, But Not By Me. It's a great title. It's a great book. And she shows what happens the moment you insult somebody or, you know, challenge their position that they're committed to. This is where cognitive dissonance kicks in. They, you know, it's like, and that began with the study of a UFO cult, since you brought that up. Leon Festinger's study in 1954 of that ended up in that famous book, When Prophecy Fails. He went up with this UFO cult to the top of the mountain when the mothership was supposed to arrive on December 21st, 1954. And, you know, these people had all, you know, given up their belongings, sold their homes, and, you know, hauled their stuff up there, and they're waiting midnight, you know, and, you know, the clock is ticking, and he's sitting there with his clipboard going, okay, well, what's going to happen when, you know, the ship doesn't come? And the ship didn't come, and there was much weeping and gnashing of teeth, you know, and, well, maybe it's, you know, Eastern Standard Time or Pacific Time, or, you know, maybe we got, right. Okay, let's wait a few more hours, and, okay, well, maybe it's tomorrow night, and they came back the next night. Oh, maybe, you know, maybe it's next year, we got the date wrong. You know, but instead of like going home and going, well, that was stupid. Okay, let's just not talk about this anymore and go back to work. No, they doubled down on their beliefs, you know, their commitment to their religion and trying to convert people to it as a way of reducing the dissonance caused by the conflict between their beliefs and the evidence. And so that's what happens if you're talking to somebody and, you know, they're committed to a position and you immediately go on the attack, that, you know, they double down. So
right.
You got to crack open the brain just a little bit through something like, you know, I understand, I'm sympathetic. Of course, your experience is powerful. I've had those too. And then maybe just offer a few little things. You know, it's like, yeah, you know, but the problem with our intuitions and our personal experiences is that they're not always reliable. I mean, you know, our intuition tells us the earth is flat and it's stable and doesn't move because that's what it feels like and looks like. Oh, yeah, but that's wrong. That intuition is wrong. And you can always show you can always show cognitive visual illusions. You know, it's like the illusion looks like this, but we know that that's wrong. You know, so our senses are not always reliable. And you just sort of go through that and try to gain some sympathy.
This kind of reminds me of two chapters that you have here in this book, Skeptic, on baloney detection. And I think it's a great breakdown of how a person can be cautious when accepting something as truth. And I think my favorite part is probably just at the beginning, where you talk about being asked by students, why should we believe you? And you reply, quote, you shouldn't. And I absolutely love this. And I think it's a great attitude to have. But do you think that anyone genuinely can feel that way, that they really do want to be challenged on everything?
Yeah, there's variation in that. Like any human trait, there's variation, gullibility versus skepticism. And as Sagan said, you know, in one of the essays I quoted him in the book on a sort of delicate balance between being so close-minded you never accept any new ideas, so skeptically accept no new ideas, and so open-minded that, you know, your brains fall out, that you believe everything. You know, there's a rub there of finding the right balance based on the evidence, on the reasonableness of the arguments, the cogency of the arguments, the internal coherency of the argument, how does it fit with the way we know the world works, you know, and so on and so on. And so that's what that baloney detection is, just offering a series of questions to ask about any particular claim.
Are there ever any moments that you remember in your life where you applied your baloney detection kit to something that you believe?
Well, yeah, again, back to where we began, you know, I was a Christian, and then I intuitively applying certain questions about my own Christian beliefs once I was out of the bubble and started, like, I took a course in anthropology in graduate school. You know, I had some free time, and I thought, well, I'll take a class in biology, evolutionary biology, to see what that was all about. And I remember sitting there in that evolution class thinking, oh my God, this stuff is real. This really happened. Holy shit. You know, because I was a Christian. I was kind of a creationist. Not seriously. I just kind of took it as part of the package. And then I remember just thinking, it's like the scales fall from my eyes. Like, wow, okay, all right, this is really undeniable. And the same thing with this anthropology course. You start studying other people's religious beliefs, amongst other things, and it's like, wow, gosh, I mean, that's completely different from what I believe. And they obviously believe just as strongly as I do. Not just Jews and Muslims or whatever, but, you know, people in South American indigenous peoples, you know, hunter-gatherer groups, that kind of thing, like the Yanomamo. And clearly, what are the chances that I happen to have gotten it right and everybody else is wrong? You know, it just plants that tiny little seed of doubt that, you know, years later ended up, you know, just abandoning my faith. And it's just that, you know, just that seed of doubt. So as skeptics, I think all we can hope to do, writings, through radio shows like this, whatever, is just people listening and thinking, huh. You know, now maybe they don't change their mind this afternoon listening to the show, but maybe a month from now, or 6 months from now, or a year from now, they go, yeah, you know, I heard that conversation on the radio, and that got me thinking, and now I'm reading this book, and then I saw this show, and, you know, before you know it, they're down the road. And usually what happens is they don't they don't make some big announcement like I hereby renounce my ex. That, you know, I mean, if you're in Congress and you change parties, you kind of have to announce it. But most people, you know, they just stop talking about it like I did, you know, with their religion or whatever. They quit going to church, but they don't make a big deal about it. That's how it happens.
Well, I think it's probably safe to say that in this case that I don't see eye to eye with every piece that you've written on every subject you've ever covered in your entire career. And in fact, I highly doubt that there's a single person that's agreed with you 100% on every piece you've ever written in your entire career. But, you know, this was a great conversation, and I hope to do it again. Maybe we can get into some of the stuff in more detail, but it was great to talk with you today. Thanks so much for coming on the show.
Oh, thank you, Matthew. I appreciate it.
And that's all for today's Equal Time for Free Thought. If you missed any part of this program or want to share it with friends, you can visit our website, equaltimeforfreethought.org, or for a more updated experience, you can go to my personal site, MatthewLeClaire.com. That's Matthew with two T's, LACLAIR.com. And remember, tune in, pay it forward, and question everything.